With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
Good morning and welcome to Reality Check Radio. This is Marie here with Counterculture. This morning, I have the pleasure to talk to Judith Hudson. Now, if the name is sounding familiar, but you just can't quite place it, Judith is the woman who was assaulted at the Posy Parker rally in Auckland and around this time last year, in fact, and you have probably seen the outcome of that court case. So I thought it was really prudent to talk to Judith, and she joins me now. Judith, thank you so much for giving us your time this morning.
You're most welcome. Pleasure to actually finally meet you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I do listen to you, especially when you've got Di Landy on. I do love to listen to Di.
Oh, I have to admit, I love talking to, I mean, she's an absolute trick, isn't she? She is such a firecracker. And it's so nice to be able to give these voices a chance to be able to be heard. So tell us a little bit more about you, Judith, because I know that you have kept a very low media footprint through all of this. So tell us, who is Judith Hobson?
A great nomad, a quilter. I'm a bit of a keyboard warrior, aren't we all these days? But that's how I spend most of my time on either quilting. I like to walk my dogs. I like to, but mostly I'm on online. Firing off one-liners that make absolutely no difference whatsoever to the state of the world, but I enjoy doing it.
Oh, so it's a form of self-expression in a way, isn't it? And so then from a gender-critical perspective, I mean, how do you then go from quilting, having your lovely nomadic lifestyle, enjoying walks with your dogs, to wanting to travel to Auckland to listen to Posy Parker? Walk me through that.
We went through a period where we were static for, well, COVID. No, we couldn't travel. We were locked down in a single park, and we weren't allowed to travel or associate with anybody. So I started going online, and mostly YouTube at that stage, just flicking through YouTube, and I came across Posy, had a listen, and I thought, oh yeah, I didn't know that was going on, hang on, you know, and then I found out she was doing a tour to New Zealand, and I thought, I'd really like to see her, I'd really, really like to go and hear what she has to say, and the more I listened, the more I wanted to go. And then we were watching the news one night. I can't believe that it's only a year since we actually stopped watching mainstream media. I can't believe how gullible we were at that stage. But yeah, we watched mainstream media, saw Chenille Lal up there on stage, sprawled out in his chair, swanning around saying how he was going to make so much noise that nobody would hear them. And I tell you, I've got a voice that would win a Texas hog calling contest. And it's very, very loud. So I thought I would go along and see if I could make myself heard and perhaps shout some of them down as well. I didn't realise at that stage that they were going to have loudspeakers, police sirens, drums, trumpets, and all the rest of the cacophony that they brought along. But anyway, yes, it was very much the last minute thing. I booked the flight at about 7 o'clock. The night before, jumped on a plane at about 6 o'clock the next morning, and I was off. So it was very, very impulsive.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting how you say, you know, it's you were listening to mainstream media at that time. So describe to me then some of the differences that you found between the videos and the content that you were watching on YouTube that, say, Posey was posting and publishing, and other authors. I'm assuming once you started down researching who you were looking at, others that were speaking in that gender critical space, versus what you were seeing broadcast on mainstream and legacy media. Did you see a correlation there? Did you see a juxtaposition? What were your impressions by looking at both of those sources of media and thinking, there's something going on here?
It was, I don't know whether you remember, but Posey started the tour in Australia.
She did.
And what I was seeing from mainstream media from Australia and what was happening there and what was, you know, what was happening at the protests and what basically the women who were coming to speak, there was no correlation at all. It was diametrically opposed. I actually couldn't believe it. I was stunned by the lies that were coming out of their mouths, and I couldn't think what they were gaining by it. What did the mainstream media gain from telling these lies? She was anti-trans, that she was a fascist, that she was a Nazi. She's never been associated with any of that rubbish. Well, she does speak out against men going into women's spaces, but that's an eminently sensible view. From my point, for safeguarding, we've fought for so long to get our own spaces, and now they're just taking them away from us. And I could see it happening right in front of my face. So anyway, yeah, I wanted to go and see what she was like in person, and I wanted to hear and speak to other women. Like I say, we're nomads, so I'm pretty isolated from social contact. And I wanted to make contact with other women in New Zealand who felt the same way I did about protecting children.
Mm. Mm.
I didn't realise at the time how insidiously the schools had been invaded. I didn't realise that Inside Out were government funded, that they were putting out sexual material for children from 7 years old that was telling them that they're born in the wrong body, that they could change their sex. I didn't know any of that. That's stuff that I've learned since then, and I'm even more now behind Posey, what Posey's doing. I'm even more behind stopping this horrible movement that is perverting our children.
So you arrived at Albert Park. You jumped on your plane at 6 a.m. You probably, what, hit Albert Park mid-morning?
I got there at 10:15. I was dropped off from the airport shuttle at 10:15 in Queen Street. And I walked up to the art gallery. yeah, that's all right. It's triggered a funny memory. I popped into the art gallery and asked them if I might use their facilities. And as I walked through, the first thing that came in my face was an all gender toilet. And I just went, oh my God.
Sort of as if to prove your point for the visit. Yeah.
Yeah. It was absolutely, oh God, no.
Welcome to Auckland, Judith.
It was pretty much that way, yeah. Used the facilities, went out, and outside was a group of ladies And I walked up to them and said, you know, hi, you up here for the post-park talk? And, oh, yeah, my name, and introduced ourselves to everybody. And I looked at my watch. It was about 11:15 by that time. And we had a little bit of a gossip, you know, women. And then we started to walk up the hill, up the stairs, up to the rotunda. And we walked along the path, and there was a young lady there, oh gosh, perhaps in her 20s. And she got her orange steward's coat on, and we told her thank you for being here, for being a steward. And then we walked towards the rotunda, and as we got further and further towards the rotunda, the noise got louder and louder and louder, and they were all behind the metal fencing at this stage. But there was one particularly loudmouthed young lady. Well, she wasn't a young lady, because she was in her 40s at least, and she was offering sexual favours, should I say? I need to get and I just turned around. Well, I did tell you I got a really loud voice. I said, do you kiss your mother with that mouth? And she took offence for some reason, and decided that I was worthy of some further attention. Anyway, doesn't matter.
The fencing.
Sorry?
I was just going to say, the fencing, when you arrived and saw them there behind that fencing, I mean, did you think at any point that that was going to maintain them? Like, did you look at that and think, oh, that doesn't look exactly like it's going to hold them?
I didn't think it would hold them, no. But I'd also seen fencing like that before, and know that if the police had been standing there, it would have held them. They would not have done it.
Yeah.
They would not have lifted that up. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I think that whole thing was organised and orchestrated. That's the impression that I got. I can't say definitively that that's what it is, but everything just seemed so orchestrated, from the absence of the police when they had actually agreed to be there and stand in that gap between the two fences, or the ribbon and the fence to help us hold the line.
Well, it's already been shown with OIA documentation that between the police and others within the Rambo community, that ultimately their involvement and what was going to happen that day was designed to fail, really. I mean, it clearly was not going to allow an exchange of freedom of speech or a safety for any women or any participants whatsoever involved. I think they certainly didn't give it the due deference that it needed to have. But, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? So then once Posey came to, so what was the moment for you when you were there, you've met these new people that have all come, like you, have come to see Posey speak, you've been confronted by this wall of protests, and it really annoys me how they call it a counter-protest, because you guys weren't there protesting, you were just having a public open meeting, so I wouldn't call that a protest. So they were the protesters. When at that point, what was the catalyst that literally sent the whole thing going? Was it Posey's arrival? Was it Eli throwing the soup? Was there a moment where all of a sudden the excrement hit the fan and you thought, uh-oh, we're all on here?
All of the above. I didn't actually see Eli throw the soup. I was there was too much crowd between us, even though I was standing on a bench. There was too many people up on the podium, which in turn shouldn't have been. There shouldn't have been that many people up there for security reasons. But I knew something had gone on when the shouting started. You know, there was people shouting out shame and all the kerfuffle of Posey getting assaulted. And then I looked over my shoulder and I saw a woman pulling out the ribbon. And I only saw her, so I thought, well, I don't like that. And I went over to her to tell her to stop it, and slipped on one of the fences and almost went down and hit her stomach with my hands. But it wasn't an impact. It was a touch, and she laughed. Mostly because she'd got so much padding around her waist that there was absolutely no danger of her getting hurt at all. I stepped away from her and got hit. But I knew it was going to turn to custard when the police didn't arrive, really.
So, for you, the trauma of that, to be 1 minute standing there, you know, trying to protect the banner and do what you're doing, and then just to be literally blindsided by the assailant, must have been utterly terrifying.
No, because I was actually stunned. I thought, what on earth? He slammed into me and my first action was to drop my foot back and brace so that I couldn't get taken off my feet, you know, to spread my weight.
Mm.
I should probably tell you that I've done some self-defense, so I did it for a number of years. So taking a stance when you do that is quite an instinctive thing to do. And I think he hit me behind the ear, and that put my vision out, and I didn't know what was going on. I just braced and thought, don't go down, not with those metal fences down there, because they had spikes on the end.
Mm.
And I thought, if you go down on those spikes, you're going to end up in hospital and you'll miss your plane. That was all I could think of. You'll miss your plane. You'll miss your flight.
Oh, how stoic of you, Judith. Very, very English and practical.
Well, I don't think my brain was actually working quite correctly at that particular time. And he came back. Sort of, it felt like he came back again, but I think perhaps he was still there. It's just I wasn't aware of him being there. Mm. And he hit me in the face, and then he drew his hand back to hit me again, and suddenly my vision came back on and I saw his fist coming towards me, and I turned my face so that he hit me on the more down the jaw a little bit, rather than in the eye again, which was where I think he was aiming for.
Mm.
Or the nose, whichever. I don't know what was going through his head. I'm not really interested, to be quite honest. It was, his thought processes do not.
Mm. I mean, did he certainly appear not to be in his right mind or body when this was happening with you?
He seemed angry. But then the lady that I'd been feeling not fair, the laughing lady, shall we call her the laughing lady? She pushed him away. And then she flicked her hand as though to say, go away. You know? And he looked at her and turned and ran.
Right.
So.
Well, she obviously knew that he had crossed a line and was potentially thinking, well, this could get a whole bunch worse. So then run us through the process since then, because obviously, I mean, a lot of people have seen the coverage, and it is harrowing to watch just from a layperson's perspective. It became a viral event. You obviously had suffered a serious assault. Then walk me through the process in regards to the police handling of this and moving through this judicial process, because, you know, this isn't just a bump or a slap or anything. This was a vicious attack on you. The entire world saw.
One of the stewards came and touched me on the shoulder and motioned back towards the rotunda. And I was actually talking to one of the protesters at the time. By that time, everybody kept saying, "Have you seen your face? Do you want to talk to the police? Do you want an ambulance?" And I kept going, "No. You know, why?"
You're still on it.
I was still on on adrenaline, I think, at that stage. And there were a lot of ladies there that really wanted me to go and see the police or really wanted me to go to the hospital. And I wouldn't, because I was frightened of missing my plane. And I was on a fixed fare and I couldn't afford to pay again for another airfare. You know, I wasn't on a flexi flight and I had to catch that plane to get home. When I got home, I really don't like talking about this much.
Honestly, Judith, you take your own time. You talk about what you're comfortable talking about.
I got home and the next day I saw what the mainstream media were doing. Lies. The complicit narrative from the politicians, and I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't. I was that more than anything, I think, rocked my world. I'd always been a person who believed in the police. I've always obeyed the law. I've always assisted the law where possible. I believed that the politicians in New Zealand were inherently good. I believed in the media. I believed the media. And my world basically fell apart. My reality, not my world, my reality fell apart at that point. Because what was it they called it after Erebus? An orchestrated litany of lies. That has been my life for a year now. And I was going to speak out about it. I was going to shout it from the rooftops. But I didn't initially get the support that I needed for that. And I sort of retreated into a little shell of loneliness for a while. I suppose it was actually shock. I don't know how else I would describe it. But I was definitely not talking very much or about anything. I went and asked for some help from somebody who I thought was more computer savvy than me to set up a channel where I could talk, and they declined to do that. And they further indicated that they didn't believe my version of events. And one of the ladies from one of the organisers of the Wellington event actually called me, or she contacted me. I'm not sure how she got my email, to be quite. Oh no, I contacted them and said, what a load of lies the mainstream media are putting out. And she picked up on my email address and contacted me, and she asked me how I was, and of course I probably burst into tears. And she said, where are you? I'm getting on a plane. And that's what she did. She dropped everything. She jumped on a plane. She hired a car, drove to where I was, and said, come on, we're going away for a few days. And she took me away. And it was, she came and fetched me, and she paid for that herself. And then, but the actual cash money for all the weekend away and all the rest of it came from Rex Landy. She put up a buy me a coffee site. And raised, I don't know, about $3,000 in one day, apparently. And it did keep coming in for a little while. But that allowed my friend and I to go away and get some peace. And before we went away, she said, I think you need to go to the police and set the record straight about what happened. So we went to a motel, contacted the police, arranged for them to come out and to talk to me and take a statement. And they came the first night and I just ran through the story. And then they said they would come again the next night to take a proper written statement. And I got up in the morning and there was a lowered ute with just dull matte grey paint sitting outside the motel window with a slim figure in it looking in the window while I was making my coffee. And they had a black hoodie on and they had a mask, but they just kept staring in at the window. And I waved, made my coffee and walked away. And I thought, I know there was nobody who knew. There was only my friend and I and the police who knew where I was. My husband didn't know. My family didn't know. Only the police. And I thought, I felt a little insecure, but I thought, you are not going to frighten me into silence. I may have thought twice about it or anything else, but they really should not have sent that car to try and shut me up. That was a step too far.
So did the police come back and take the full statement?
They did. But there were two policemen the first night, and the second night it was the same senior officer who was a very, very nice man. The second officer was a different one from the first night. And the reason for that, I think, was because my friend and I both got a really, really bad feeling about the first that young officer. It's really hard to tell because so much of it is his feelings, and they're not. That's not proof for anything else. It was just this feeling, As soon as they walked out, we both turned to each other and said, "Did you get a bad feeling?" And we laughed at each other because we both said exactly the same thing. So we were both very much working on instinct.
So they opened an investigation based on your complaint, and
Then you've got what you've got there is a disconnect because we were in a different city by then. I'd flown out of Auckland and I was in a different city, so I reported it in a different city. He took the statement and he said, "I will be sending this through to Auckland, and they will handle the complaint because this is where the incident happened." And I sort of said, "Well, you might as well throw it into the rubbish bin then, because it's not going to get acted on in Auckland," which was the way I felt after they'd let us down, you know, by not being at the protest. I thought, "Oh, yes, this is that's going to go in the circular filing cabinet." And that it was sent through, and it was it because it had already got a file number in. They had to process it, but we were contacted and told, and somebody wanted to know what the name and address of my assailant was.
Right, because you totally took his details after he bashed you in the face. I mean, you said, "Excuse me, pet, can I have your name and your address? Thanks." You know, I mean,
That's right.
really? That's ridiculous, Judah.
That's pretty much what we thought too. Really? This isn't because his name will never be known. They don't think that anything will ever come of the complaint.
So who tracked this young man down? Because obviously the vision came out. So there was obviously already work going on behind the scenes with those from Stand Up for Women and that were at that the citizen journalists that took a lot of footage. So that was obviously going on without you being aware. So footage turned up. So who actually tracked this young chap down? Was it the police or was it the work of civilians who had a
It
vested
was
interest in
civilians.
finding them? It was civilians. Wow.
Civilians, just civilians. They the footage was put up on the internet. Another very tech, I don't know whether they actually want me to say their names or not, but I don't know their I don't know a lot of their names. I only know their tags online. There are some people out there who have got very good IT skills, and from the footage, the original 360 footage that was put up, it was gone through, and somebody managed to isolate the face of the person who attacked me and enlarge it and put up a wanted poster. Bless him. He put up a wanted poster, but then again, nothing came of that for a week or so. And then somebody offered a reward for his identification. And the person who offered the reward was contacted by the police, and they said, "Please take it down. You are interfering with our investigation." And so he took the reward down, and the next day, my attacker walked into the police station of his hometown, and he didn't hand himself in. He was winkled out, is what I felt. He saw the level of public outrage. I actually think, I mean, this was what, 2 weeks later? If he'd had a sudden burst of conscience, I think he would have walked forward the next day, same day, next day, within a couple of days, thinking, "Oh shit, maybe I ought to go forward and apologize to this lady." And to be honest with you, I would have taken his apology. I seriously would. I would have said, it's okay, mate. Everybody was a bit upset. It was not a good situation for anybody to be in. Don't do it again. But he didn't. He made us winkle him out. And that, when they said, would you go for diversion? I just thought, not on your life. It was way too late for that one.
Yeah. So let's cycle around to the case. And I also want to talk about your victim impact statement, because, you know, there's been huge outrage around the sentencing, and we'll get to that. But your victim impact statement, I've read it. It is a really good, concise, I think, telling of what went on. What stunned me when I got a copy of it was, I would say easily 60% of it was redacted. Why was so much of it redacted and not allowed to be able to be read out in court by you?
Because it was not, it did not concern his actions. It concerned the impact on me of other events that were involved, like the fact that the police weren't there when they should have been, like the betrayal of politicians who apparently don't know what a woman is, and mainstream media outright lying about what went on, like the ridiculous communication we got that said that they'd never be able to find him because I didn't get the name and address, or his name and address were not available. Like, I said no to diversion, and all of a sudden he was granted diversion, and the papers went missing, and all that was in the statement, but it was basically a criticism of the judicial system of New Zealand, and they didn't want that read into the court record.
But surely all of those were mitigating factors, particularly around your criticism with the government and the media, to how the crowd, will particularly the protest, their trans activist protest, it sort of led to that frenzy. I mean, his lawyer in court said that he was caught up in a frenzy. Well, how was that frenzy created? I thought you touched on that in your victim impact statement, and yet that was not allowed to be read.
No, because it didn't actually concern, as far as they were concerned, it didn't concern his actions. And let's face it, the judge sure didn't want that up there, nor did the police prosecutor. They consider it too subjective and not pertinent to the case anyway. And the defence lawyer were not going to, let me say, half anything that put him in a bad light, like the fact that he had to be winkled out and basically dragged into the police station, not the fact that he was, you know, that they put the spin on it that he walked in there of his own free will. Well, he didn't. He was dragged in there by, I'm not sure whether it was his uncle or his father, but it was, he did not go forward of his own free will. And if he hadn't presented himself, I don't know.
So then the remorse that the judge talked of in the sentencing of this young man, and then the hours of community service, do you, I mean, the way you're telling it, was there remorse? Did you sense remorse from him in that courthouse?
No. No. He was frightened. He was frightened that he wasn't going to get off. He was nervous. should I say. But I don't think he was remorseful at all. No, the only remorse he was that he got found out. You know, that he eventually people found him, and that the shenanigans that went on didn't get him the diversion that he wanted.
When you left court, you said, "I'm absolutely livid that he's walked out of court, and in my opinion, with virtually no consequences whatsoever. It's no wonder victims don't go to court because they are victims all over again." Which I thought you summed that up so cogently, considering you must have been stunned at that decision.
It was pretty much the decision that I expected them to make. Not because that's what I wanted, but because all through this last year, it's been him and his lawyer and his family wriggling and manipulating and trying to sweep this under the carpet. That's been the whole focus of this police investigation, if you can call it an investigation. It's like it's been influenced pretty hard to make it go away. So it was, I was angry that all I asked for in court was his name not to be suppressed. That's the only thing I asked for. I knew he was going to walk, but I wanted people to know at least that he had been involved in violence. And they, of course, they poo-pooed that idea and gave him lifetime name suppression, which carries much more severe. If you breach that, you get much more severe consequences than you do if you go around and punch an old lady in the face.
It's interesting that you say that, because I've gone on the record last week with another show that I'm in, and I looked at the situation, knowing a little bit about the judicial process. And my thoughts actually were the opposite. I thought I was a lot more comfortable with the name suppression only because of the internet backlash and the things that can happen incorrectly, and you know how it does turn into a maelstrom on the internet. But I believe that the fact that he didn't get a conviction was completely wrong. He should have been convicted. So that was on his record to actually be there as a permanent reminder that those actions are not permissible in a civilized society.
I do actually agree with you.
And yes, it will actually probably hamstring him for a time. But, you know, I think also too that if he were motivated, surely that would give him the kick in the trousers to actually, you know, pull his socks up and make sure that he gets himself on the straight and narrow. And I say that too because I'm a mother of a neurodiverse child. So I get really annoyed when they take that neurodiversity and they use it as sort of like a flag and a bastion. Oh no, we can't do this because he's neurodiverse. Now, the thing is they think and function and operate differently. But at the end of the day, if you're a parent, or in this case, he's an adult and he's fallen foul of the judicial system, that doesn't justify his actions. I think he needs to have a reminder of what he did. But also too, I'm quite angry as well, which is why I wanted to speak to you today, of the media's complicitness in all of this. And as you described, what prompted you to even go to the rally in the first place is seeing what the media portrayed, and you at that time had a trust in the media versus what you believe to be true, and there was a complete disconnect. And that has continued all the way through to his sentencing last week.
Yeah. The reason why I only asked for his name to be published be made public was because I already knew that he was going to walk. It was fairly obvious. I'm not saying that anybody had told me that he was going to walk, but I've been watching the courts and watching the sort of sentencing that New Zealand judges are handing down, and they're a joke.
Yeah, and Judge Glubb had, I think, had another case where he was very lenient on sentencing within a similar vein for this. So is there anything that you want to say to our listeners today, Judith, that you weren't able to say in court, whether it be from that victim impact statement or feelings that you have that you think, you know what, I just want to get this out and on the record. Is there anything you want to share with us in regards to this entire process and where things are moving forward today?
The way things are moving forward in New Zealand, I am disturbed about. We've had a change of government. That change of government came about because people were absolutely fed up to the back teeth with Labour and the Maori Party and the Greens running roughshod over everybody's rights and just making New Zealand their playground, if you understand what I mean with that.
They ideological were, playground.
It was indeed. And the fact that so many New Zealanders voted against them, and by that I'm begging everybody's pardon because I cannot understand how on earth anybody voted Green. Having seen the quality of their MPs, I can't understand why anybody would vote for them, but that's just me. We voted for change, definitely voted for change. And Luxon and the Coalition have been doing their very, very best to change the things that they said they were going to change in the first 100 days. But Inside Out has got to be defunded. It has got to be got out of schools. The Disinformation Project has got to be disfunded. Now, they both operate as classically charities. That's how they're listed, as charities. They are not charities. They are government-funded organisations. The government pays for them to exist, even if it's under the table or under some other umbrella.
There's a lot of what there's a lot of softball contracts, let's put it this way, that keep them rolling in money.
Yeah. It's like the the funds that Labour gave to
The Public Interest Journalism Fund?
That's the one, yeah. You can have that contract as long as you say exactly what we want you to, and if you don't say what we like, then we're going to turn your money into a loan and you are required to pay it back, was what was printed on that one. And I think pretty much, sorry.
No. I was just going to say, well, where to for you now? I mean, you sound like you've still got a bit of spirit there going, Judith, even though I know behind the scenes that you have been dealing with a tremendous amount. It sounds like you've still got a lot of spirit there. What about, so you, Warrior Judith, what is Warrior Judith's plans moving forward?
I want to get with people like Auntie Hei Hei and with Manawahini Kororo, and I want to start planning for our children's future, because I don't think that cities work, and our cities, the way they have deteriorated, the modern city does not work. It doesn't work for children, I don't think. They are put in front of a screen and that is all they learn. That's their world. And there are rivers and there are lakes and there are trees to climb and places to explore. And there is grandma and granddad, there is auntie and uncle who all need to be helping to bring up those children, not just a screen and mum and dad. We need communities back again. We need our communities. God, when I was young,
Well, I think that's a vision that a lot of our RCR listeners will certainly resonate with. And I know I certainly resonate with it as well. I live in the provinces, so I completely understand that. Judith, I just want to thank you for your time today. You've been incredibly generous with it. You've been incredibly brave because I know it's not easy recounting this. So I just, again, want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me this morning.
It's been my pleasure, Marie. Thank you very much for asking me to speak.
No, oh, you're most welcome. This has been Judith Hobson. She was the woman attacked at Albert Park in Auckland, and it has been so great to talk to her today. Thank you very much, and don't disappear, of course, here in Counterculture Store. Still much more to talk about. You know me, there's always more to talk about, so don't disappear here on Reality Check Radio. Thanks, Judith.
Thank you.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.